Today's program is brought to you by Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing, taking place on Saturday, June 18th at Nettle Meadow Farm. For more information, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every week, Tuesday from roughly 12 to 12:45 on the Heritage Radio Network here in Bushwick, Brooklyn! How you doing? How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
A little crazy on the Bushwick today, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why I have to go crazy on the Bushwick? Because this is one of Jackie Molecule's, Jack Inslee's, last weeks here in Bushwick.
Next week is last week.
Next week's his last week.
Next week will be my last in-studio live cooking issues for the time being.
Forever.
Wow.
Forever, says Stas.
Yeah. Where's the awe voice?
The what?
Where's the awe voice?
Oh, I know, right? All I have is this.
I like that. You want to hear some good news? My phone decided it would be funny to erase all of the stuff that I had prepared to talk today. So I'm going to have you call up the questions, and then I'll make the answers.
There's only one.
No, there's that extra question that you got.
There's two.
And then there's one from last week. All of those. Because I didn't get to answer any questions last week because we had Jim Leahy on. You couldn't miss it because you were stuck in my anus.
Right.
Mine is Connecticut.
Yep.
For those of you that weren't tuned in last week, Nastasia borrowed a stick shift, 1993 stick shift Saab that for some reason one of her friends decides is a good New York City car to have. And the clutch cylinder leaked its oil, its last breath on the way back to New York City. And she was stuck in the beautiful hamlet of Mianus, part of Greenwich, Connecticut. Do you know, you lived in Greenwich for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Do they, honestly, because my son Booker is like, enough with the bathroom humor, Dad. You and your precious Mianus, that's what he says, because mm-hmm. we pass the sign all the time. Do they pronounce it Mianus or do they pronounce it Mianus?
I've never heard anybody say that word, ever.
If there's anyone who lives in the Greenwich, Connecticut area, we got to find someone who lives around there, maybe someone from the neighboring Coscob, who can tell us.
You could look it up, right?
How are you going to look it up?
I'm looking it up right now.
Do you know that if you look up the pronunciation on there's people whose only thing that they do in life is make fake pronunciations and put them on the internet to mess things up? There's something called like pronunciation guide that literally is just some guy mispronouncing words on purpose. So I just don't trust the internet. And plus,
well, the internet says it's my anise.
Yeah,
my anise, as in my star.
Yeah.
No. My anise? What is it? Some sort of tropical? It's Greenwich. My anise. Is it mayonnaise? Is it like some sort of like French mayonnaise alike? Makes no sense.
Yeah, we got to get somebody to call in with that.
Yeah, I need someone from Greenwich. Preferably a hater, right? Who like, you know, grew up like, you know, fighting the local like Mianus Warriors growing up or whatever the name of their team is. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, give it to me straight. Give it to me straight. Okay, so we have some questions, but as I say, they've been lost, so Nastasia's finding those, and I'll start with the one that I have here. Dear Dave, Nastasia, Jack, Peter, who's not here because Peter just doesn't care, right? Right, Stas?
He said he couldn't make it.
Yeah, couldn't make it. Yeah. And it's only like, you know, one of Jack's last days.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Peter.
I don't think he knows that.
Well, yeah, he
could. No, I told him.
Oh!
Yeah. Where are you, Peter?
Wow. Wow. And the gang. I've been reading up on British desserts. Mistake. No, I'm kidding. I've been reading up on British desserts, and they use double cream, which has about 48% milk fat. I haven't been able to find this in the USA. Is there any way I could take that heavy cream and either add more milk fat without a homogenizer or remove water to bump the milk fat content from 35 to 48? Thanks for all the great work, Tom Fisher. Well, look, it depends on what you want to do with it. I mean, you can boil cream down to a very, very high fat content. But then the question is, I'm not sure what you want to do with it afterwards, whether that's going to alter the flavor. You can't just melt butter or butter fat and add it in because, remember, the cream is a fat in water emulsion, and butter is the reverse. It's a water in fat emulsion. So we used to do the experiment with Harold McGee at the French Culinary, where we would take cream, which is fat in water, right? Whenever you're talking about an emulsion, you first name the thing that's you know, formed in pockets, that's not the continuous phase, and then you say what it's in, which is the continuous phase. So it's, you know, fat globules. Do you hate the word globule?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Distributed in a water in a water base, you know, waterish. And so then you beat it, you know, until the fat particles agglomerate. You break the emulsion, and now you have the reverse. You have a water in water droplet in oil emulsion, which is butter. So you can't really fortify it. You can mount it and do a revert, like a mounted thing, but it's not going to be the same. But luckily for you, you know, if you get nice fresh cream and it's, you know, doesn't have any like high acidity or anything like that, you can boil it down and get pretty much whatever fat content you want. Now, you might be affecting, or you will be affecting, the taste and the whipping properties. But I didn't have time to look what the standard recipe for making it is, because I'm pretty sure that, you know, it's going to be hard to get 48% fat straight from the cow just rising up on the top unless you really spin it down. Although, you know what, Scott? Like, I could spin it in the centrifuge and get it pretty easily, because I can make butter in the centrifuge. But I don't know if I can – I guess I could probably enrich it to that level. But you're getting real close, you know, to like having it just automatically form a dense kind of a butter anyway. You know what else I've never noticed, Oz? The quote-unquote butter that you make in the centrifuge when you spin butter in the centrifuge, I wonder whether it's actually butter or just really solidified cream. Like, I wonder whether you've actually broken the emulsion. I think you probably have, because you get that thin buttermilk. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, speaking of centrifuge... that was from Tom Fisher, by the way. I wonder, like, should we put an all-points bulletin out for people to tell us what they want the centrifuge to be able to do?
Why?
The new one? Just so we get more feedback from people before we release what the prototype is going to do, so I can test recipes. Like, right now, I already know that the centrifuge we're working on can do strawberries, tomato, orange, lime, lemon, you know, banana, justino, dates... I know it can do parsley oil. I know it can do pea butter. I know it can do some kinds of nut milks and stuff like this, but maybe we should try to figure out what people want it to do so I can test the recipes. I don't know. If any of you guys have any things that you are dying to have a centrifuge be able to do, I can test it on my prototype.
Send it back.
What?
Whips, send it back.
No, we don't. You're wrong.
Just got an email.
Nastasia's talking about stuff that you don't have any idea what we're talking about. I might as well be speaking in a language. I might as well be speaking. We have a prototype here. We have a prototype here that I'm going to send back. They're sending us another one, and in fact, we just need to send a rotor, of which I have three for testing.
Okay.
Nastasia, again, talking about stuff that you out there don't care about or don't know.
They love knowing.
Who between the two of us, who's the one that spent an hour from midnight to 1 a.m. talking to them yesterday? Oh, me. Okay. Anyway, so the yes, we had to send some stuff back, but we can still run tests, and I have four units in the U.S. Four. Anyway, a little bit of Dave anger on a Tuesday. Well, it's like a Monday though. I haven't seen
it's
you.
It's like it's a weird Monday.
It's
Tuesday
like
thing.
Yeah, it's like Monday anger on a Tuesday.
There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of like. Bad traffic on the way here.
Yeah?
Weird attitudes. Well, I think everybody's confused and hungover.
It's New York when it's hot, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, Nastasia hates it, I think, as much as I do, don't you?
Yes.
Did you go anywhere fun over the weekend?
No. How would I?
The face.
The same way that you always do, by taking a train or stealing the car that you just... Nastasia literally just got a car fixed.
Right.
Just paid to get her buddy's car fixed. Her buddy with this car is in Seoul. So she's like, how would I get out of the city?
Rent a place.
You don't have to sleep over somewhere. You can leave the city. You know, I've done it many times.
I'm on Team Stas here, though. Like, it's the worst weekend to go places, I think.
I'll tell you what. I drove back yesterday. Not a big deal.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Not a big deal.
From Connecticut?
Yeah.
What time?
Like 3.
Okay.
Not a big deal. In fact, saw some accidents. Still didn't cause too much problems on the traffic on the way back. But, you know, Nastasia wants to be martyr. Poor me.
I'm not.
Where would I go?
I'm saying you know that I wouldn't go anywhere.
What would I do? Anyway, so... you know, whatever. You know what the thing is? It's like if I were to say, hey, are you going to be around this weekend? She's like, what do you think? I stay wherever you want me?
That's not true. You know I'm always in New York.
No, that's not true. You're always doing something. Constantly. I'm going out to the Hamptons to visit my dirtbag buddies. No, I'm going to this.
Ooh, dirtbag buddies.
Dirtbag buddies. Oh, my God. Nastasia has some. Do you know Booker has started calling all of Dax's buddies dirtbag buddies?
Yeah, so we're going to name a band that, too.
Dirtbag buddies? Yeah. And so now my wife, Jen, is like, you have to stop using the word dirtbag because the kids are picking it up. What do you think, Stas?
No comment.
Do you think I should stop saying dirtbag?
You say a lot of things that they pick up. A lot.
Look. That's not necessarily
I've
the case.
I've heard Dax talk exactly like you.
Well, yeah. Oh, speaking of things that they picked up, my kids have picked up. This is not cooking related, so we'll try to get off it quickly. But my kids have, without any actual physical contact, picked up my hatred of geese, of Canadian geese. Because I was, like, driving by. If you've ever lived in the Northeast and spent in the suburbs and spent, you know, this time of year, and you go to any pond that has a lawn next to it, right, you need a pond with a lawn next to it. It is infested with freaking Canadian geese. And right now, this time of year, is when they have their rancid little goslings. And when Canadian geese have their goslings, if you want your children to grow up with a healthy hatred of Canadian geese, just throw them on the side of a pond with freaking geese and their goslings, because they're the most vicious creatures that because if you didn't know better, you'd be like, oh, geese, what are they going to do, right? You ever been attacked by a goose?
Mm-mm.
It's nuts, man.
Oh, yeah. My little brother was attacked once when he was a kid, and then that was it.
Yeah. They, like, start hiss. First of all, they start hissing like some sort of, like creature from a horror show. And then they run at you, like, snapping and hissing with their wings giving you the... They're giving you this one, Stas. What? 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 With the wings. You know what I mean? And they're running at you. And just do that, like, once or twice with it. There's a book written by, I forget her name, but she's writes about how to poach animals. I'm not advocating for that. But she said, I think it was her, who wrote that if you ever want your kids to never be vegetarians and to always support the killing of animals, expose them as often as possible to geese.
Did you see the gorilla?
I felt so bad about that.
I know.
Yeah.
But you know what I looked up?
How did he get in there?
It's unclear yet how the kid got in there, but here's the real. So what we're talking about, for those of you that haven't been following the news, is Cincinnati or something like this?
Mm-hmm.
3-year-old or 4 or something like this kid makes it into the gorilla pen, falls 10 feet down into this moat where this like 450-pound silverback, 17-year-old silverback gorilla is. I forget the gorilla's name. And the gorilla's like, what? You know what I mean? It starts, like, dragging this kid around. And the video is like, oh, my God, it's crazy. So they shot the gorilla to death. I looked it up. There's no such thing as a tranquilizer that'll take a gorilla down.
Why is there like not this. Such a thing as a tranquilizer that could do that?
That's
my question.
I don't know. But first thing, my Dax and I were like, what the hell? Why can't they just shoot it with a tranquilizer dart? Why do they have to kill the freaking gorilla? It's horrible. It's not the gorilla's fault. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then, you know, I saw all these scads of things on the internet saying that there's nothing that can reliably take a gorilla down in less than about 30 seconds. And, you know, and what you don't want is an enraged, pissed off gorilla that's just been trank darted, like taking a kid and smacking it around on a bunch of concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But the gorilla didn't look mad at the kid.
No. And the kid didn't look fazed.
What
gorilla
the
looked like he was kind of taking care of the kid. Mm-hmm. It was weird.
Well, I mean, I just don't, the gorilla, like, you know, what does the gorilla know about how fragile a 3-year-old human is? You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know. The gorilla looked like a lot less intent on damaging that kid than, you know, my dog did eating frogs this weekend. My dog turned into such a frog murderer this weekend. Like, there are frogs everywhere. And he would see a frog and then instantly start foaming at the mouth as if rabbit and jump after the frog and just be like, ah, and my kids were like, don't eat the frog, don't eat the frog. I'm like, the dog's a carnivore.
Right.
The dog is a freaking carnivore. It's like you're feeding it chummed up chicken and cow and lamb every day out of a can, and you're worried about a frog? A frog, an amphibian that doesn't even have a sense of play? Mm-hmm. And like, you're okay, whatever. I mean, don't get me started. Don't get me started. Okay. So, Stas, you find the other question?
There's one other question.
There's two.
From last week?
There's last week. There's the John Oliver one, and then there's the other one that came in. So why don't you just read it?
Hello, and thank you for making this a great podcast. First, it seems to me that other than mixers and cheaters, not much advancement was made in the process of making puff pastry and croissants over the years. Making it is time-consuming and requires much skill and practice. Can you suggest a modern ingredient or method that might help in the process? Preheats keeping the butter from soaking in the dough or melting at room temperature. Maybe even, and forgive me for the heresy, use less butter.
Heresy.
Use less butter and still get separate flaky layers. Second, in order to keep the puff...
Let's do one at a time. So the question is there any new tricks for puff pastry? And he mentioned croissant too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say I've only made you don't like croissant, right, Stas?
No.
What's worse, a croissant or a biscuit?
Equal.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, if the croissant has chocolate in it, then it's fine.
What about almond?
No.
What if you had chocolate in a biscuit?
No.
But chocolate and croissant, yeah. Okay.
I'm kind of intrigued by the chocolate biscuit idea, Dave.
Well, I'm telling you, you heard it here first, people. Yeah. Cooking issues, chocolate inside of a biscuit. It'd be easy enough to do.
Yeah.
I mean, freaking simple. You know what I mean? They bake for roughly the same amount of time as a croissant bakes.
Yeah.
And they bake at roughly the same temperature that a croissant bakes. So, and they're cooked through as much as a croissant is. So I'm going to go ahead and say that you could do a chocolate biscuit. You know, standard baking powder biscuit, buttermilk biscuit. Okay. I made croissant exactly once in my life. It was well over 20 years ago, and it was in the middle of the freaking summer in an unair-conditioned house. So it sucked. And I was like, when I made them, they've tasted fine, but I was like, this crap is not worth it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad I made it once. I'm never going to do it again. So I don't have a lot of experience with croissant, but I have made a bunch of puff pastry. And I've never really tried to make it, I've never really tried to tech it up. I looked up the patent literature on this, and there are a bunch of people that have patents out. On puff pastry, specifically trying to lower the fat content of puff pastry, because for some reason this is the kind of thing that people are interested in doing. Not me personally. Like, I'd rather just have puff pastries. But what they did was, so when you're making puff pastry, obviously the idea is you have a laminated dough, you have the dough layers, and you have the fat in between them. Now, back when I was paying attention to such things, people always said that it was the water in the butter that was the important part that would blast that would steam and blast the layers apart. But now most people say that the water in the dough does the same thing as the water in the butter. Although I've never tried making puff pastry with a solid fat that didn't have any water in it at all. And I'm pretty sure that the puff pastry fats that they make specifically for making super light flaky puff pastries, which are a technical marvel, if terrible for you, they are because they're all trans, although they probably have trans fat free ones now. But those like are awesome, but I think that those are emulsions with water in them, like a standard margarine, but they're done for puff pastry. Anyways, so you need this separation and you need the dough layers to not stick together so that they can puff apart. So there's a fella, I forget his name because I don't have it in front of me anymore, but who had a patent out on making a thickened starch water along with fat emulsion so that it had the plasticity and laminating characteristics of margarine, but instead of being 80 to 82% fat, was like 40 to 45% fat. And so that would be a significant fat reduction, and according to the patent, it works. But as Nastassi and I both know, any idiot can write a patent, even if the stuff doesn't work, and they'll get it. You know what I mean?
It's true.
A lot of people don't know this, but if you write a patent, it doesn't mean you could literally, if you write a patent, you never have to prove that the sucker works. You just have to make up a good enough story for the patent officer to believe that you come up with, in fact, people have patented things that are physically impossible to do, and they slipped it past, a patent officer who, I don't know, high as a kite or drunk as a skunk or whatever, wasn't paying any attention. And there are people, I forget, who collect these kind of absurd patents as kind of little things. Anyway, so let's go on to the second question.
Second, in order to keep the potency of rarely used spices, hello, pink peppercorn, I store those in the freezer. Assuming I keep condensation at check, is there any reason repeated freezing and thawing might hurt them? And is the same true for nuts?
Nuts. Okay, so to look up my suspicions, Nastassi, you'll enjoy this, I think. I looked up UC Davis's PDF on nut storage, and UC Davis, they know from nuts. They The safe handling of nuts. How awesome is that as a PDF title? The safe handling of nuts. Gently, mm-hmm. gently. I believe is it anyway. So the point is that. And McCormick, if you look up what McCormick tells you not to freeze dry spices just because it's unnecessary. But let's break down what's going on here. There are several things you need to worry about when you're dealing with spices. So in general, dried spices are those things that have been deemed for millennia in some cases to withstand the rigors of shipment on boats and long storage and still retain potency, and as long as they're kept whole, not ground, for long, long periods of time. That's why they are the spices that we use, because they are items of commerce that can be shipped over long distances. So they tend to store rather well without any sort of freezing or refrigeration. Now, most, you are going to extend the life of these things. Where these things get damaged is, A, yes, they will volatilize their aromas off over time and decrease their potency. Some of them will also probably alter in flavor over time. But you have two main things. You have water damage due to condensation, which is obviously enhanced by cycling through different temperatures where you get condensation on it. So that's why repeatedly bringing it in and out of cold can be problematic unless it's stored under a vacuum. So if it's stored under a vacuum, you can bring something in and out and you're not going to get condensation because there's not any extra vapor in there to have water that can damage it through repeated freeze-thaw cycles. But I doubt you're going to get that much of an advantage on that versus just storing it in a vacuum container. Also remember, every time you suck a vacuum, you're sucking volatiles off of it. Now, are you really going to notice? I don't think so. But a good way to do this, if you really want to do it, is to vacuum these things into smaller packages and keep them vacked down so you're not repeatedly vacuuming and unvacuuming them time and time again. So that's in terms of keeping. But the other thing, and this is where, you know, the some spices, but also these nuts and like seeds and things like
nice.
That. Yeah. Are important is rancidity, right? So your nuts are going to go rancid if you leave them out at room temperature for a long time. And in fact, I just had an interesting a pack of black walnuts, American-grown black walnuts. I'm not going to get into that joke. Anyway, but it's a family show. Jim Leahy, how long did it take us to tell Jim that it was a family show?
Yeah, that was, it
was
happened
he
quickly.
Surprised it was a family show?
I think he was surprised it was a family show, and then it's just not in his nature to turn off the bleep bombs. You know
but
what
his
I mean?
Bernie Sanders impression was excellent.
Well, that's what, yes, we also had to be like, it's not a political show. Not a political show,
yeah.
Family show. You can listen to, I don't care what your, I mean, within reason, I don't care what your political beliefs are. But, anyway, back to what I was saying, nuts. So they're going to go rancid. In fact, I've got these black walnuts, and they had gone rancid in a really kind of interesting way. Stassi, were you here when we ate with Paul and Don those, I think Don was here, those ants?
Yeah.
Did you eat one?
Yeah.
Remember how disgusting they were? But like greasy and but fruity greasy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, most of the time when I taste rancid nuts, it's more that cardboard kind of rancidity that you get with oil, where you can taste oil and see that it's gone off and it's getting rancid. But these walnuts had that fruity rancidity. It was so weird. Anyway, so they go rancid, very obviously. So you're going to want to store your nuts in a vacuum if possible, and nuts are good in the freezer. But you also – you want, like I say, if you store it in a vacuum and you can get rid of the air, you're not going to get condensation even through a couple of freeze-thaw cycles. But other than that, I would say that airtight storage and buying them whole and buying high quality is the way to go. And unless you're cooking professionally – so if you're cooking professionally – people in general, it depends on what kind of professional cooking. If you're dealing in a large kind of institutional environment where you're expecting someone to follow measurements, like you will use 5 grams of pink peppercorn, right? Then consistency of your pink peppercorn over time is super important. But if you're just cooking, or even if you're a real cook in a restaurant and you can adjust on the fly, typically these kind of spices will just lose potency over time, and so you can just jack the quantity. This is why, like we were talking before when Kenji was in and someone on the internet said that bay leaves don't have flavor. Remember that, Jack?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I'm Stas, remember that? And And I was like, it's wrong. Just use more because you have crappy ones. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so a lot of times I think you're probably better off just jacking the quantity a little bit. I mean, I know I do that. I mean, most of us use those kinds of things to taste anyhow, right? Anyway. Okay, so what was the other – we had another question in from Norway, right? You sent it to me last night.
Okay.
Yeah, while we're looking it up – no, but they were in two separate emails. I lost any changes I made to my emails.
All emails?
Yeah. So anyway, so why don't we go to commercial break? We'll get that question. We'll come back with more cooking issues.
And the break song here is called Forks by Slow Roasters. We'll be right back.
Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing is a celebration of good food and beverages in the newly restored Barn Loft event venue at Nettle Meadow Farm in Thurman, New York. On Saturday, June 18th, come sample and savor, then buy your favorite cheeses and beverages to take home. Nettle Meadow cheeses have been praised highly in national media and have won prestigious awards from the American Cheese Society. Taste samples of goat and sheep cheeses paired with an array of local regional wines, beers, and ciders. You'll never forget your first sample of rich, creamy Kunik, Nettle Meadow's trademark cheese. In Esquire, our very own Ann Saxelby said, "Kunik, it may very well be the sexiest cheese in the USA." Nettle Meadow Farm is a goat and sheep dairy and cheese company in Thurman, New York, just below Crane Mountain in the Adirondacks, between Gore Mountain, North Creek, and Warrensburg. It's owned and operated by Lorraine Limbiase and Sheila Flanagan. Both have a great love of animals, artisan cheese, and the unique challenges of farm life. Nettle Meadow Farm was originally founded in 1990, and it's the home of over 300 goats, dozens of sheep, and a variety of farm sanctuary animals. Again, the cheese and spirits pairing is Saturday, June 18th. For more information and tickets, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
All right.
All right, and we are back. So we had this question in. By the way, you can call your cooking questions in, too, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. This in from Arnie Olson. Hey, guys, and thanks for a great show. I have a question about limequat. Limequat. Remember the limequats?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, you know what? So limequat is, I don't know whether it's technically a mix between a kumquat and a lime, but they're these little kumquat-y things. You eat the whole thing like a lime, right?
I don't like eating the kumquats, really.
What?
Yeah.
What are you? You going to Nastasia on me here?
Why?
A little bit. I don't know. I don't like eating the rind, you know?
But the rind's the best part of the kumquat.
Yeah.
That's where the fruit. I happen to freaking love kumquats. Like, I completely denuded Harold McGee's kumquat tree, which is a gross sounding sentence, I know. But like, it was it never came back from what I did. I just wiped it out. I basically sat there and chewed on the whole plant until the kumquats were gone. And then when Nastasia and Harold and I visited Gene Lester's citrus farm, we were like, bathing in different kinds of kumquats and limequats and stuff. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I like the kumquat better than the limequat.
Yeah.
I like a good old-fashioned, orange-colored kumquat. Mm-hmm. Jack, I feel you need to give the kumquat another chance.
Yeah. Oh, I'm open to it. I'm not hardline on these things. Just like the last time I had kumquats, I don't remember, like, loving them.
How did you have them?
Well, whole, you know.
Do you like sour things?
Yeah. I might have just had a bad batch. It's possible.
I guess. You know what I don't like about them is every once in a while the seeds will tick me off. You know what I mean? I don't know. What do you think about biting into a kumquat seed, Stas?
Not good.
Not good?
Mm-mm.
No. But I love a kumquat. I don't really cook with them. I just eat them. We've tried to make cocktails out of them. I've never been like, oh my God, that's the best cocktail I've ever had. I've made garnishes with them. Done a bunch of candied them.
Yeah.
But I think they're best just eaten.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You know what? I think the last time I had one, it was a garnish.
Yeah.
And it might have just not been like the highest quality, you know?
Yeah. And plus, what was it garnishing? Do you remember?
I don't.
Yeah. Hmm. I have a question about limequat. I have been fermenting all sorts of things lately, and I threw some limequat wedges in with some chilies and Turkish sour green plums. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Turkish word here. Yezil Eric Tavazi, I guess is what it is. I've actually had, if it's the ones I'm thinking of, they're in season I forget when exactly they're in season. It's when I was in Istanbul is when they were in season. And they're good. And, you know, remember we had, you know...
That was in May.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it's running around now? Okay. But here's anyway. The liquid has become a lot more viscous. What do you think about that word?
It's okay.
Yeah. Viscous than I've experienced before, and the only differing thing this time were the lime quads. The plums haven't behaved like this before, so I assume it's not them. I haven't been able to find anything online about hydrocolloid properties of lime quad or kumquat. I used a brine of about 4% salt. The change in viscosity happened fast before any significant drop in pH can have occurred. After a few hours, and it hasn't changed after a month. Any ideas? Huh, no. That is really weird. I know that Harold McGee has had snotty preserved lemons before. Like, they've gone, like, his preserved lemons have gone all snotty on him. But that is probably due to halophilic bacteria that were making some sort of mucilage. So typically, like, I wouldn't imagine that the limes... here's an interesting thing, though. The limes are far more acidic than the plums are, right? I mean, the plums are acidic, but the lime quads are more acidic still. I wonder if you, as a test, just took some of the plums and jacked the acidity up a little bit to the same kind of acidity level you had. I wonder whether it's just some sort of weird pectin phenomenon, like you have solubilized some pectin, and then when you lower the acidity, it's doing some sort of like pre-gel or set or something like this. Because my guess is that it's not an aspect of the citrus itself. It's an aspect of the acidity of the environment dropping with the addition of the lime quad. But you know what? You said there wasn't a significant drop in pH. So that must mean you've been measuring it. And if you're measuring it, you know what the pH was. So I don't know. I've never heard of any weird hydrocolloid property in a lime quad or anything else. But maybe some people in the chat room have something to say. Now, remember, my lime quad experience is solely based on Nastasia and I eating the hell out of them on Gene Lester's farm. I've never shopped for lime quads, nor have I sourced lime quads. Or, you know, the only sort of quat that I have sourced is kumquats. What was that drink name we're going to make for that kumquat thing that Derek
had? I can't remember his last name.
Cramps. Yeah, what was it? Anyway, we'll figure it out. We have a kumquat dish, a kumquat drink at the bar. And Nastasia came up with an awesome name for it, which is not the name that you can order it from at the bar, but it was like something in the cramquats. What was it? It was like...
Was it just Derek?
Yeah, it's Derek, yes. Something
just Derek in the cramquats?
Derek in the cramquats?
Maybe.
Anyways, so the answer is I don't know. We also had someone write in and wanted us to look at the John Oliver... What's his show called? This week, tonight.
Something like that.
Tonight, this week, tonight, or something like this. Tomorrow, yesterday, tonight this week.
This week,
yeah. He's a funny dude. Anyway, he did something on science that, scientific studies and food specifically, that someone wanted us to read and look at rather and comment on. And I have to say that I think it was hilarious. Everybody should go to John Oliver's website and look at his 22 or 23 minute, rant basically on how crappy most food science studies are and how they're mishandled by the media.
Last week tonight.
I think it's pretty much spot on. I mean, like, it's a subject that I plan on going more in depth on. If I ever finish or start writing the book that I'm supposed to write, I'm going to have a chapter on kind of what I consider the pyramid of garbage that most of these, a lot of these studies are based on. But I don't want to go into it now, because if I go half-cocked on it, someone will call me out and tell me that I'm a terrible, uneducated fool, right? As has happened before. Okay, so that's that. Those are the questions that are in. So now I'm going to talk about some stuff I want to do. First of all, Nastasia, I'm going to redo my outdoor cooking situation again, right? Because no matter what I do, I cannot get in a situation where people will be in the same freaking area while I'm cooking. It still is completely antisocial. Like, my tandoor is like crammed outside. No one wants to hang out where the tandoor is. You know what I mean? Also, like, you know how I'm cheap? Yeah, she's nodding her head
yes,
up and down.
Yes.
Yeah, cheap. So, everyone, you know, the big thing over the past couple of years, people want, they want a fire pit, right? Because people want to hang out in the fire
pit.
I
thought you have a fire pit.
I did. So, but I bought the cheap one, right? From the Home Depot. It's called the Cowboy Grill, but it doubles as a grill. But I'm like, I'm never going to use this thing as a grill. I actually used it as a grill. Because now I have those benches around the grill. Remember the chainsaw? The tree fell down.
Yes.
I cut all those benches with the chainsaw because, you know, I think chainsaw art is like, you know, I like, I'm not good at it, but like, I like, everybody really likes playing with chainsaws, don't you think?
Okay.
Wouldn't you like playing with a chainsaw?
No.
You have no desire to play with chainsaws?
No.
Jack, you?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
My, I used to like not wake up when I was a kid, you know, I'd like sleep in and stuff, and my grandpa once walked into my room with a chainsaw.
Wow.
Like revved it up. That did the trick.
Wow. Where was grandpa from?
Sicily.
Nice. So like crazy Sicilian grandpa with a chainsaw.
Yep.
That'll get you up.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I like chainsaws. I have not yet been severely damaged by one, thank goodness. Anyway, so I had this cowboy grill, and I have to say, you know, I'm a big fan of the vertical grilling and the tandoor, but I was like, I'm going to try to cook something so people can actually hang out with me while I'm cooking, so I have all the benches. So those things actually cook like a monster because they are like, imagine a Weber grill that is like 2.5 feet across. Or more. How big is this, Dust? Like 3 feet?
Mm-hmm.
It's like 3 feet across. So what you do is, the way you use this, and so I'm actually recommending this as a cooking implement, strangely, is you take a chimney, starter for charcoal. You fill it full of hardwood charcoal. I use the Cowboy brand because it fits with the Cowboy grill. Actually, it's just the one I use, the red one. And you put, actually, it's not Cowboy. Maybe it's Royal Oak. And you pour it into the chimney thing. You put one thing of paper underneath. You light it with the torch. And the coals start after like 20 minutes. We've all used chimney starters, right? Now, a chimney starter is in no way, shape, form, kind, color enough charcoal to cook on this thing because it's like, it would be the equivalent of putting like 2 pieces of charcoal in a Weber, right? It's like nothing. So what you do is you dump the chimney down and then you build your teepee of like, you know, how big is that, Stas, across?
2 inches?
All right. You take like your 2-inch sticks and you layer them like a teepee over the burning coals, and then you take your big pieces of like firewood that you use for fire and you make another teepee around that. And because the coals are so hot, the wood lights in like in less than like 20 minutes, the wood is already so on fire that you can spread it out over the entire thing. And now you have like a 3-foot circle of instant death that you can put the grill on top of, and it's just a freaking monster. Like, it's such a freaking monster. I did bluefish on it, so, like, I put them, you know, I have those, I have, like, infinite kinds of, like, skewers and baskets for my tandoor. So, like, I, you know, I'm doing it, and I was like, man, this sucker really freaking cranks. So I would say, if you're a fan of Weber-style cooking, go get you a Cowboy grill if you really need to cook for a lot of people. Because does anyone like waiting around to like swap stuff off and on the Weber grill?
No.
Everybody hates it, right? And so the cool thing about this is it's got a little swing over grate that's like a warming grate. It's like a second level above the other one, and you can kind of adjust the height of that. And it's got a swing over for a boil kettle, right? So it swings over. So what you do is, but you know, like a lot of people, what they want to do when they're grilling is they want to switch the height of their grill up and down to adjust the heat. I find that cooking with the tandoor, what you want to do is get a uniform kind of like high heat. Although I don't know whether it's talking on air or talking later with Jim. I've lowered my super high cooking temperatures pretty much across the board. So now with my tandoor, I kind of do a first burnout low. Then I put all my breads in, my naans, because I find that my... Was I talking about this on air, Jack?
I think so.
I was talking about lowering the temperature of the to bake the naans.
I think so. Stas, what do you
she wasn't here. She was
here. Oh, last week.
She was in my anus during the whole show. You know? Anyway.
You may want to repeat it anyway. Last
all right,
week
right. So in other words, way. Like, normally with a tandoor, you get a scorching hot, right? And then you want... And I think this is the same as true with, like, most pizzas. I think most pizza doughs and most pizzas, you know, I've been doing super, super hot for a long time, and I'm thinking I like now to reduce the temperatures a little bit. I find I like the interior texture better if the bake time's a little bit longer. And so lower temperature. So what I'll do is for the tandoor is I'll do a relatively long fire to fire it up to like a nice even temp, do my breads, and then I'll throw another chimney of charcoal in to do my meats, my like shrimp, stuff that you want like really fast. Anyway, but I find with the grill, I think most things, and this is another thing that I've been thinking a lot about recently, is moisture control and surface effects. And I think you can gain a lot when you're grilling by just going off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, or putting on the warm and just like constantly moving the thing around. So you don't really need to worry, I think, about having a billion different heat levels as long as you're on top of it. You know what I mean? If you want to be a jamoke and just throw something on the hot side for a couple seconds to, a couple minutes to make the crust and then throw it on the cold side, I guess you could do that too. But, you know, I find that if you just keep the thing cranking at a pretty hardcore rate, you can just slam the stuff out as long as you're on top of it. Anyway, so Cowboy Grill, I'm definitely pro. The other thing that I'm going to do this summer – oh, but here's why I brought it up. So then the next day when we had a bunch of people coming over, right, after I grilled the bluefish, my first bluefish of the season, delicious. Do you like bluefish?
I don't know.
Huh, Jack, you like bluefish?
Yeah.
I love bluefish. Bluefish is now becoming popular because everyone now is liking fish that they didn't used to like.
Yeah, it is around a lot now.
Yeah, it's delicious, but it's oily. You know what I mean? And so, like, if you talk to an old timer, like when I bought it, they were like, "When did that fish come in?" And the guy was like, "Today, of course." Because what are they going to say? And you're just like, "No, no. When was it caught?" And he's like, "Freaking today. Today. Freaking today." You know what I mean? And she wouldn't buy it until I bought a piece and she smelled my piece. She's like, "Okay, I'll take a piece." You know what I mean? I don't know why the guy didn't just offer to let her smell the fish in the first place. So I had to be an intermediary at whatever. And I did the old school. You know, have I talked about this on here? You know the old school with bluefish, the old timer's recipe is to put mayonnaise on the bluefish. You know what the old theory, which is garbage, is the oil gets out oil. It doesn't make any freaking sense. But the mayonnaise.
Wipe it off?
No. No, that's why it doesn't make any freaking sense. But the mayonnaise is good. It forms like a nice crust. So you mayonnaise, salt, pepper, and then only on the meat side, not on the skin side.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then the next day when a bunch of people came over, they're like, "You know what? We don't want to sit with you next to the grill while you're cooking all the food. We're going to sit on the deck." I'm like, "Of course." Wah, wah. So now I want to build a deck-friendly cooking thing. And here's the thing. When you're cooking outside, what are you missing? Usually.
Don't know.
A way to cook things that want to be cooked on ranges, right? So a lot of people will take a wok and they'll try to put it on their grill, which I think is weak, or they'll do a bunch of other things. They'll put pans on grills, which I think is problematic. But I'm going to build an outdoor wok burner. So I need some advice from people. I'm either going to get what's called the Big Kahuna, which is a gas-fired 65,000 BTU propane wok burner, or buy one of those Thai charcoal stoves that you like hold a wok, or maybe get both. I don't know, but I'm going to get the wok burner. And the other problem is that, you know why I don't use my outdoor fryer enough, Stas?
No.
Because my outdoor fryer is not sealed. I realize this is that if you have to completely drain, clean, dry, and store a fryer every time you use it, especially when you're using 6 gallons of oil, you don't do it that often. You know what I mean? Whereas if I could just have my fryer act like my indoor fryer, like completely seal it from all pests, then I can just strain it, keep the oil in fine feather, cover it, and then just go back and fry with it. Because honestly, if you're just making like 4 or 5 pounds of tortilla chips or like a couple of chickens, are you really going to sit there and fill an entire fryer with 6 gallons of oil, then at the end of the night strain it out, clean it, and drop it in? Whereas back when it was sitting at home inside, I would just fire up the freaking fryer, do the tortilla chips, let it cool down, and cover it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to work on that. I'll let you know. I'll let you people, good people, know. Another thing is that I know I said earlier at the beginning of the year that this was going to be the year of starch. I finally started working on it. Right now, my newest thing, I tweeted it out or something, potato starch. Big on potato starch. I've been working on the Korean fried chicken, my Korean fried chicken recipe. I'm getting very close to a Korean fried chicken that I like. Jack, you like Korean fried chicken?
Yes.
Stas, you like Korean fried chicken? You like, what do you like better, American fried chicken or Korean fried
American.
Chicken?
American.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. What style of American fried chicken? What's your ultimate fried chicken style?
Mm.
Don't know.
Mine's hot chicken, like Nashville style hot chicken.
So how's that? Like, I've never been to Nashville. So what's
that? Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's just fried chicken with a shit ton of spice on it. Oops, sorry for the curse.
Family show. So is the crust more like a KFC original, more like an X Crispy, more like a Popeyes, more like a traditional Southern soft crust?
Yeah, like no, it's a crunchy crust.
Yeah.
Thick
crunchy crust.
Uh huh.
See, the interesting thing about the Kentucky fried chicken, Korean fried chicken, obviously, is that it's like super thin. So some people, when they do the recipes for it, they do a thin batter, which is, I think, a mistake. And this goes back to what I was saying before about it's all about moisture control. So obviously, everybody who really knows how to do this, right, they do multiple fryings. And what you're doing during the multiple fryings is controlling the crust, controlling the formation of the skin and the crust, which is why you can get a hyper thin shattering crust on a Korean fried chicken using fundamentally just the skin. So what I'm working towards, and you know, the Koreans use these small chickens and they fry the whole thing whole, right? I want to do a larger American style in the of chicken in using low temp cooking. So I've been testing with low temp cooking first, and then doing a triple fry on it with potato starch as the base for the crust. And I want to do a Blues Brothers four whole fried chickens and dry white toast dinner. Now, the thing is, I figured out I'm pretty close. I'd say I'm 95% of the way there with being able to make four whole fried chickens that are delicious all the way through, perfect. But what I've not been able to do yet is make dry white toast that I want to eat by itself. Do you know what I'm saying? You guys familiar with this movie?
No.
You've never seen the Blues Brothers?
Yeah. I've seen it.
So they walk. They're trying to get McIntyre Murphy to leave Aretha Franklin, where they're working at this greasy spoon in Chicago, and go out on the road with them to form the band because they're on a mission from God, right? Okay. So what they do is they go in there, and Belushi orders four whole fried chickens, and Dan Aykroyd orders dry white toast, and that's how McIntyre Murphy knows that the Blues Brothers, this is what they eat. But who the hell eats dry white toast on its own?
Don't know.
Can you imagine? Can anyone imagine what good dry white toast to eat on its own is? Like, what would it mean to make dry white toast that you would eat on its own? Is Dan Aykroyd just trying to say, like, I'm a horrible person? And Belushi is trying to say, I merely am a hedonist and I want four whole fried chickens and therefore I will eat whole. And then Dan Aykroyd is just like, I am just a non-entity, even though, like, that's clearly not the case. What do you think, Jack? What do you think about the dry white toast? I don't know. Maybe he had to duck out, I guess. But, like, the dry white toast is not something that I can imagine. I've thought a lot about toast, right? The texture of toast. Like, when you eat toast, what kind of toast do you like?
Just white toast.
Yeah, but what is the texture like?
Oh, crunchy?
You like crunchy. So more of a British, more like a Melba toast, like where you break it in half and it shatters into a million pieces?
No. You need like a good crunch on the outside and then a little bit of chew in the middle, yeah.
Right. So you're dealing with another moisture control problem. And this is, we talked about this before when that guy came and we did that TV shoot about toast. The guy wasn't even thinking straight about it. When a toaster is done, what do you do? What's the first thing you do when the toaster goes, if you have a toaster oven, if it's not a pop-up, what do you do?
Take the toast out.
Open the freaking door to let the moisture come out or it's going to be ruined. What's the worst thing you can do to toast? Take it and put it on a plate right away. You're ruining the freaking toast. Because when you put the toast on the plate, have you never done this? You take toast right out of the toaster, you put it on the plate, you let it sit there. What happens when you lift the toast?
I don't know.
There's all water and steam and condensed garbage underneath the toast. And the bottom of the toast is ruined. Dax did this to toast over the weekend because I made some seafood salad and we had it, seafood salad sandwiches and he made the toast. And he did that to the toast and it was all I could do not to, like, lose it. You don't want steamed. Jack, are you with me on this?
Yeah, definitely. And Erica's back here. She says you need a toast rack.
Yeah. So I have a whole bunch. Erica's totally right. I have a whole bunch of quarter. And this is, by the way, something that everyone should buy. And this is another thing. I'm actually talking to my editor about it. Is a kitchen organization in general. Even though I'm the most disorganized person on earth, I think that actually gives me some reason to be interested in the idea of kitchen organization. I have stacks of quarter racks. And so quarter sheet pan rack is very useful for moving stuff around. And they're very kind of portable and they stack up. So my toaster, literally on top of my toaster, are stacks of quarter racks that I can just put whatever. pancakes, toast, anything that has a moisture control problem. So the whole kind of thing boils down to everything is moisture control. Fried chicken is a moisture control problem. Toast is a moisture control problem. All of these things, grilling properly to get the crust right before the inside is done, is a moisture control problem. And that is, in essence, all I think about all day is getting the outside and the inside at their proper kind of moistures and doneness at the right time. And all the tech that we use, all the low temperature cooking, really all we're doing is trying to more effectively make the inside be the way we want and the outside be the way we want. So it all comes down to moisture control, cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.